Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism.
The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word. Hello and welcome to another week of Diffusion, hot and fresh out of the 2SER oven. Whether you're joining us here in Sydney or somewhere on the Community Radio Network, we have some interesting tidbits in store for you this week, including another visit from our friends, the beer-drinking scientists, as well as a critique on your old faithful shoes and jeans. Perhaps not quite as faithful as you once might have thought. But up first is Patrick Ruby with the news. I'm Emily Fern, your host for this morning.
Electronic tags could be used to keep track of people with dementia. The new technology is being trialled in Britain, where it's still under debate whether the increased safety and security of patients is worth the potential loss of freedom. The devices developed can work by triggering an alarm if the wearer passes a detector on a boundary, or can be tracked with a handheld device. Similar technologies are associated with tagging newborn babies in maternity wards and criminals. A new robot surgeon will be able to assist doctors in operations on the brain. Its Canadian makers at the University of Calgary claim that the surgical robot, called NeuroArm, will be able to assist during magnetic resonance imaging procedures and will let doctors perform delicate neurosurgical techniques human hands would not normally be dexterous enough to perform. The robot is controlled through force feedback handles, allowing surgeons to feel the pressure and texture of the tissues and blood vessels the robot is operating on. The robot cost $27 million Canadian dollars to develop, and clinical testing of it will start soon. The first fish teeth might have grown as land animals started to evolve. Harvard paleontologists report that one of the first fish with teeth, Acanthostega, lived in the Devonian era some 375 million years ago, and fossils show it as a transitional form between land and sea vertebrate. Adaptations might have made sense as the species began to live in shallower waters and changed their feeding style. The sun's outer atmosphere can be further revealed through sound waves. Yura Toroya of the University of Sheffield, UK, has identified the acoustic waves which vibrate in structures called coronal loops and trace the sun's magnetic field in its outer atmosphere. The wave microflare would sound something like a loud boom if we could hear it. Daily doses of aspirin might reduce your risk of cancer. A study by the American Cancer Society shows that daily use of adult-strength aspirin over a 5-year period is associated with a reduction in overall cancer risk by 15%. Further confirmation in randomized trials is still needed to determine if reduced risk of cancer can be considered a benefit of aspirin use. A species of soil mite has become sexually active again after millions of years of being asexual. Almost 1 in 10 soil mites reproduce by parthenogenesis, producing clone-like offspring. The sexual reproduction characteristics are still in these animals, but are unused. Roy Norton of the State University of New York made the exciting discovery and claims sexual reproduction might be an advantage to the mite if it is moving to a more challenging environment.
Thank you, Pat. Dressed for success, or distress. Suits, ties and high-heel shoes. It would seem that we are increasingly being controlled by the restraints of fashion. Literally. Katrina Allen investigates.
Dressed for success, or distress. If you believe advertisements and popular movies, presenting a neat, tidy, fashionable image projects intelligence, breeding, and can help to land you the perfect job as well as your dream date. But this success may come at a price. It seems that much of our dressier clothing may create health problems. One issue is constriction. Only a few decades ago, men wore suspenders to keep their trousers up. Now most use belts, which continuously constrict the abdomen during use. Tight belts have been proposed, controversially, as one of the reasons for the increase in rates of esophageal cancer. Stomach acids may be forced upwards, causing acid reflux and esophageal damage, which can lead to cancer. Studies on the wearing of back support belts used by people who lift heavy weights, such as removalists, have shown them to increase diastolic blood pressure. Extrapolating, this suggests that the constriction caused by a regular belt may also increase blood pressure, raising the risk of heart disease or stroke. In women, the health effects of old-fashioned corsets are well known. Less well known, however, are the issues associated with the wearing of modern bras. Like corsets, these also constrict the chest, though nothing like a corset. Pressure from bras has been shown to slow digestion, reduce autonomic nervous system activity, responsible for organ functioning, and interfere with the temperature regulation of the body. Tight underpants and trousers such as jeans constrict the groin and increase scrotal temperatures, reducing fertility in men. Even boxer shorts may prove too cozy and warm an environment for healthy sperm development. Neckties, particularly when worn with a tightly buttoned shirt collar, can constrict blood flow across the neck. This has been shown to lead to increased pressure within the eyes and, by implication, within the head. Higher pressure in the eyes may increase the risk of glaucoma, and increased intracranial pressure may increase the likelihood of strokes. But speaking of ties, let's also not forget how much of a breeding ground a necktie can be. Food spills, sweat, saliva, and mucus from sneezing can provide an ideal environment for unhealthy bacteria. One particularly disgusting study I found looked at contamination levels between regular ties and bow ties worn by gynecologists. It found no difference in bacterial levels after a day or two. Every time your tie touches your hands, your face, or even your lunch, harmful bacteria can spread. Your feet are another obvious source of trouble. Fashionable shoes can lead to serious foot pain and deformity in later life. Studies of shoe choice have shown that most men and women choose shoes far too narrow and often too short for their feet, with a surface area of the sole often lower than the surface area of the bottom of the foot. Narrow shoes lead to corns, bunions, and foot pain. Short shoes create toe deformities over time. High heels, those above 2.5 centimetres, are also associated with bunions and painfully callous skin. Poor shoe choice could also lead to higher risk of fall-related injuries. But then that's not just shoes. Tight skirts and low-slung pants and trousers may impede movement and may lead to more falls. Though on the other hand, flowing clothing can lead to burns if people are incautious around open flames or heaters. And then think of the added issues with cosmetics. Manicures, nail varnishes and acrylic nails, for example, all involve some level of exposure to organic toxins such as acetone and toluene. Linked to cancer, neurotoxicity and respiratory problems, these chemicals may impact the wearer. Certainly people with a heavy exposure to these chemicals, such as nail technicians, show slight but significant decreases in cognitive reasoning, memory and learning abilities. So does this mean that snazzy dressers are dumber, more deformed, spread disease and have lower IQs than slobs? I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced, but I might bring up these arguments when next told to spruce up.
So what do you think? Should we have a clothing revolution? Return to the basics? Email us your opinion at diffusion@2ser.com. Maybe we should take a leaf out of Adam and Eve's book. Just don't choose poison ivy.
Now here we go, dropping science, dropping it all over. Like bumping around the town like when you're driving a Range Rover. Been dropping the new science, and I've been kicking the new knowledge.
And I see to a degree that you can't get in college.
It's the sound of science.
And now, for your listening pleasure, we have the song Be Good or Be Gone by Irish artist Fionn Regan.
happened to read this. Rose was born, child actress, on the fifth day of the snow. Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone. Her range was staggering, movement and timing, frame by frame. It did unfold. Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone. I read to you on Saturday. Museum has closed down. Sell all your things at the end of the drive. Be good or be gone. Be good or be I have become an aerial view of a coastal town that you once knew. Be good or be gone. Be good or be
again today are our beer-drinking scientists Mark West and Darren Osborne. They wanted to find out what the public think about cloning and where you might draw the line with stem cell research. And where better to get these answers than at the pub. It's amazing what a couple of shardies can coax out of people.
So if you could be cloned, would you be?
Sure, but only in a miniature size.
So you want a mini-me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a mini-me would be really cool. I mean, you'd get into all sorts of places that you couldn't normally get into. Yeah.
Would you be psychically linked? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that'd be also pretty cool. And if you could kind of, I don't know, get some kind of weird powers that you could, when you combine, like Transformers, like Voltron.
Like Voltron? So then I guess it goes without saying that if, you know, you or your someone, some loved one was sick and the only way that they could be cured was through some therapeutic cloning or something, you reckon that'd be alright?
Seriously? I'd have to say no. No.
If the cloning was only for, like, to make 10 cells or something in a baby, is that too many?
I would say that's fine, but yeah, you're right. Where do you draw the line? I mean, you can't... As long as you don't create, like, a whole living... Well, you always were living, but, like, something which has a consciousness... then, to me, that's reasonably ethical.
You can support somebody else's health through transplantation or donation, and that can be very different than cloning, and I think cloning takes it another step that it's a whole new area that I think is very different than being able to support somebody through a disease process.
Somewhere in the middle there is, like, growing a new liver out of your... out of your cells, and the only way to do it is to create an embryo of 10 cells big. Is that morally bad?
Look, I don't say it's morally bad. I don't think that I could agree with it because it's hard to know where the end point is. And I believe in some way a Darwinian, it is a bit survival of the fittest. And I think it's a fine line between where you want everybody to survive and where some people have to die. And it's whole death and dying. I think we have to accept to a certain point that people are going to die, and that's part of life, ironically, is that death is ultimately part of life. And I don't think we can support everybody in this life. And I think it's very difficult to decide who lives and who dies. And I think that's one of the big issues with where we go with cloning and being able to want to try and give everybody life. And that may not always be what the intention was when we were born in the first place.
If it was my sister or my kids, then I would say, sure, whatever you need, build another liver.
Part of the issue is we don't accept that death is part of life. And I think for all of us, we want to preserve life ultimately to the end. And I believe, what is that end point? And none of us really know. And we accept that at 85, you've had a good life, but at 5, you haven't. And I agree, but does that mean that we go down this path, and what is that? Because I don't believe we ultimately know what that in path is, and I think that could be very scary.
You could say the same for, you know, I had pneumonia when I was 3.
Yeah.
50, 100 years ago, I would have died. Take it another step, and I offer some of my stem cell, whatever, for a liver for my children. Is that, you could argue that it's the same as providing an antibiotic for pneumonia.
But I think that's where we have to define what actually cloning is. What is cloning? What is bone marrow transplantation? What is donor organ? I believe in organ donation. I believe in bone marrow transplantation. But I believe cloning in itself, I don't think we have a defined definition of what that is. And I think that can be very different.
I was just going to say that I think there are some areas of medicine that you could put the funding towards that could save a lot more people, particularly things like finding a effective malaria vaccination.
Yeah.
And so I think it's sending medicine in an area where there's going to be perhaps a lot of value, because it is providing some benefit for first world, whereas it's a bit like this whole space travel and funding space travel. I just find that it is public purse being wasted.
Yeah. So you'd be better off working on water purification than cloning, or like you say, malaria.
Die of diarrhea than they die of sort of dysfunctional livers or sort of genetic diseases. I mean, you know, that's basic. You need to look at sanitation and all those sort of basic malaria, AIDS, all those sort of, you know, tuberculosis.
Yeah. Like defining age, we all want to be 20 for the rest of our lives. So I think we see that finding a cure for every disease that we come across is ultimately what the aim is. But I don't believe that's what it should be. I think we're losing track in some ways of, what life is.
I think what you have to do is you have to remove yourself from the person or relating yourself to a personal situation. Because I have a really close friend who has an incredibly sick child who has kidneys that don't work. And, of course, you know, for her and for them, I would want this kind of medical development. But I think governments and institutions as a whole have to think outside of the person and think of people.
Yeah.
Stem cell research, cloning, I don't think there's enough information in the press about it, and I think at the moment, so whether or not I want a clone of me, be fantastic, but don't tell the missus in whatever country I might be in at that particular time. Stem cell research, quite possibly a good idea. Cloning to have lots of other people for, say, redundant organs and stuff like that, not entirely sure. But I'm not informed enough to know about it. As I say, what do we know about anything?
For the entire Beer Drinking Scientist spiel, visit their website at bds.podbean.com. Next we have The Wigs, all the way from Georgia, USA, with their song Technology from the album Give Them All a Big Fat Lip.
It's a scientific fact.
A scientific fact.
It has to be correct.
It has to be exact.
Because it is a scientific fact.
Old blue eyes might not be so sharp. Can your eye colour affect your vision? Recent research into blue-eyed men has shown that not only do they prefer blue-eyed women in photographs, they are also more likely to form a relationship with them than with women of any other eye colour. Since blue eyes are a recessive trait, blue-eyed parents should only be able to have blue-eyed children. Thus, by selecting a mate of the same unusual eye colour, one hypothesis suggests that men can easily spot an offspring of an affair, ensuring that the children they help raise are most probably their own. So flashing those baby blues may be good on the dating scene, at least if you're trying to net yourself a blue-eyed beau, but when it comes to vision, they may prove a bit of a disadvantage. But firstly, why do humans have different eye colours? It mostly comes down to the amount and location of melanin. Yes, the same substance which controls skin colour. and where it's found in the human eye. Pale eyes, such as blue, grey or green eyes, contain little melanin, dark brown eyes more. Which eye colour you get is primarily determined from genetic variation based on the eye colour of your parents. But how does your eye colour influence how well you see? The darker the eyes, the more light is absorbed as light waves pass through the eye, and thus less light is available to reflect within the eye. Light reflection, called scatter, can cause susceptibility to glare, such as from sun or headlights, and also to poor contrast discernment. Thus it seems that people with darker eyes may have better vision in high glare situations. Perhaps this makes them better night drivers, for example. This may also affect your colour vision. Here it seems that lighter eyes may provide some advantages. By allowing more light in, blue or grey eyes appear to make it easier to discriminate between colours. So it seems to me that blue-eyed people should really go for dark-eyed partners. This way one can pick the paint colours and the other can drive home at night.
And that's a wrap for Diffusion for today. You've been listening to Mark West, Kachina Allen, Darren Osborne, Patrick Ruby and myself, Emily Fern. Today's show was skillfully produced by the lovely Celine Steinfeld. It could not have been done without her. If you want to relive this week's science magic or to hear past episodes, head to www.diffusionradio.com. We'd love to hear from you, so if you need justified procrastination time, send any questions, comments, or hot science topics along to diffusion@2ser.com. We hope you have a lovely, jubbly, sciencey week.
Bye!
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone. I have become an aerial view of a coastal town you once knew. Be good or be gone.